Welcome to Get a Move On, the podcast for movement lovers who are fed up with their injuries and want to enhance their all-round health. On this podcast, I'll help you change how you think about pain and illness so you can drop the frustration and move freely. I'm Amy, an osteopath turned yoga teacher and mindset coach. On this pod, I'll be talking about the joys of pain, injury and illness, the mind-body connection, and how they relate to our movement practice so you can get a move on.
Hey everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Get a Move On with Amy Slevin. As always, I'm Jamie and I'm helping to co-host the podcast. Amy, how are you?
I'm pretty cool, Jamie. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm looking forward to today. You know, last week we discussed values, so if you haven't checked that episode out, I'd recommend it. Not because it's totally necessary to understand today, but it is some nice context. Anyway, today we're going to be discussing values, but we're going to be diving deeper and talking about them in the context of relationships. So I guess the first question is, Amy, why are we interested in values in the context of relationships?
So I was thinking about this because this particular podcast is kind of aimed at movement lovers who potentially have sort of like illnesses or injuries or whatever. We need to tie this in. So the tie-in basically is that no man is an island unto himself. Like, we all have interactions with other people, and it can be like a brief interaction in a kind of shop or a kind of, I don't know, fleeting moment of an interaction. But we also have our relationships with our friends, our lovers, our family, which can potentially have an impact on us, right? So they can be quite stressful. They can also lift or lower our mood, right? They have a dramatic effect on our everyday life. And so some of that can be quite stressful. And we know that stress has an effect on our bodies, which is going to be another episode that we're going to have on like specifically what happens. And it can affect our sporting performance, because if we're distracted by something, an argument or something that we've had with someone, then it can influence how we perform in the sport. It can potentially increase our likelihood of getting injured, or it can interfere with our injury rehab and our kind of capacity to heal. So that's kind of the tie-in. And we just can't get away from relationships, right? They're just everywhere. And so I thought it'd be useful to be able to understand how each of our own set of values, which is what we discussed last week, plays a part in us and our interactions with other people.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. And nothing in our lives, especially movement, can be taken in isolation. And a constant feature is the nature of our relationships. And that, by the way, means our relationships in the movement and without. The interesting thing for me here, though, is how our values tie into the quality of our relationships and how understanding other people's values gives us an opportunity to be practically improving of our relationships.
Totally. And that is what it's all about. So it's all about kind of having enough consideration and care for the people around us, especially the ones that we're most close to, which ironically are the ones that we tend to have the most friction and stress with. And caring enough about their values that then we have a more harmonious relationship.
Yeah, so what does it mean in practice then to care about someone else's values?
Okay, so obviously we all have the stuff that we're into and we have a hierarchy of the thing that is like the most important thing to us and the thing that is like the least important thing, which we discussed last week. And we sometimes have a tendency, each of us, to expect other people to be into the same stuff that we are. So for example, I've been so guilty of this. I'm like, oh, I had this amazing experience. I love this thing. Therefore, I want you to have this amazing experience too. And I want you to benefit from this thing that is so important and meaningful for me. And then we kind of like sometimes reach reality of the interaction with that person when they're like, I don't want to do that. And then we kind of get frustrated about, well, why do you not want to do this thing that's so cool? So for example, like, you love going to football matches. You invited me to go to a football match with you once, probably more than once. And I was like, oh God, that is so not my idea of having a good time. Like, being surrounded by like drunk, shouty men is just not my idea of a good time. Okay. But you love it. And you want to share that experience with me, because you're like, oh, Amos, it's so cool. And we did once go to a Wimbledon match. And it was like a real interesting learning experience for me. And basically, like, I didn't really want to go, but you sold it to me because you gave a shit about what's important to me. You sold it to me in a way of this is going to be interesting for you because of X, Y, and Z, which was, you're going to see how human beings are in a kind of tribal kind of situation. You're going to see sort of human behavior. You're going to see movement and different ways that footballers move around the pitch and how they kind of move their bodies. And so then I was like, okay, now I'm interested.
And that's the point, right? Because for every single activity, there's a million potential appeals. You can go to football to enjoy the social stuff. You could be fascinated by the tactical detail. You could be interested in how footballers move. You could be interested in the policy of how stewards operate. There's a near infinite number of reasons to be interested. And it's kind of, I guess, about selling things or translating things into the values or priorities of other people such that they give a shit, such that your relationship's okay.
Precisely. And I think a lot of the time the problem comes when we try to impose our values on other people and they don't respond in the way that we want them to. And we're like, yo, what's the problem? Like, just do the thing that I want you to do. And they're like, and then they get resistant. And we're like, no, I don't want to. And the more we try to impose that onto them, the more pushback we're going to get. And then if they do the thing, it's likely that they're going to be resentful. And they'll do the thing like, oh, fine. I don't know, I'll go with you to football, but I'm going to sit here and just like read The Economist.
Yeah, and the point is that our values we see as just like natural truths. Like, obviously this thing is super exciting. I had this experience from it. I just can't imagine that you wouldn't. And we miss the fact that if you wanted someone to have like the type of experience you want to have, which is always the case, right? You're never really interested in them experiencing the same sensory data as you. You want them to have the internal experience of, oh, that was so cool. But we're not excited from giving them that experience, really, in the way that we know would reliably do it. So I didn't say to you, Amy, let's go parkouring. Even though I had some sense that more reliably than going to the football, that would give you a sense of fulfillment and enjoyment. It just seemed very obvious to me at the time, and it seems very obvious to everyone always, that the activity-specific thing that you're into is the same activity for everyone else, even though on one level you kind of acknowledge that, well, had they been into it, they will have shown any interest previously. So with that context set and the landscape of, like, God, everyone's sort of trying to impose their own values on other people, there's a resentment there. We kind of know on one level that we shouldn't be doing it, but we do anyway. Like, how specifically do you see that to be toxic to relationships? And what's an example of a solution? Like, you know, because you're going to be very close to people who don't care about the same things you care about. And that's inevitable. So how are we managing that?
Well, I think that's the funny thing about romantic relationships in particular. And it's funny, like with friendships, we don't have the same expectations that we do with romantic relationships. And also kind of a little bit in families, but I think it's kind of also a bit different in families because you could have a parent who highly values, and I'm thinking of a kind of someone in particular, highly values family, children, and then whose daughter got married. And basically the mum was like, okay, you're married now. Are you going to have babies like immediately? And the daughter was like, I'm not sure actually. And the mum was like, but hold on a minute, you're married now. What's the problem? And the daughter's like, whoa, just like, give me a minute to be married. She was really young at the time as well. But the imposition of her mum trying to say, okay, it's time for grandchildren for me. There was a bit of friction there. There was a bit of like stress in their relationship. Whereas if the mom had just like respected, okay, cool. So this is what I consider important, which is, you know, I love being a young mom. And therefore I think you should too. If the mom just sort of respects that the daughter isn't quite at that stage yet, isn't quite ready for that, has a bit of her own sort of path or self-discovery to kind of get through first, then that would kind of take off the pressure. Then their daughter would be kind of less stressed in herself, thinking, oh God, like I've got to think about having babies now, but I'm not sure if I'm ready yet. Oh, and then, you know, she has a kind of internal conflict because of this outside influence. And this is just an example of, you know, one in many.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful example to demonstrate how we really do impose our values on other people. Because to have kids is a seriously big deal. And nonetheless, we're happy to impose that for all the biological and responsibility and financial changes. We're happy to go on, crack on then. Like, I want grandkids. And it never occurs to us in that moment, if you're the wannabe grandma, never occurs to you, well, like, even though I had fun doing it, it wouldn't necessarily be fun for them. And wouldn't our relationship be better if they felt like I was meeting them at where they were, as opposed to exerting a pressure, now they feel guilty and now picking up the phone to me, there's this elephant in the room, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. And look, I've been on the receiving end of that pressure too. It's tough. But actually, it's not that like the daughter didn't want a family. She was just like, I'm just not ready yet. And so it is a kind of a values thing. It's not that she didn't value the family and having her own kids. It's just that at the moment she had a higher priority. Her higher value was on a bit of career stuff and discovering her true path.
Yeah. And like, we just really do want to be met where we are, you know? And that's why it's really cool to see, like, you know, the like butch dad going to ballet with their daughter. It's why those images are always quite heartwarming, because you're like, okay, God, he really isn't interested in this thing. But he's kind of going the mile because she is interested. And then the reason that's extra sweet is because now imagine how loved she'll feel, etc. And I think we really do just want to be acknowledged for where we are.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's just like dad and taking you to football. You know, so not his thing. Like, you know, he's there on his BlackBerry back in the day, or with The Economist, or whatever he's looking at. But for him, family is mega important. So he's kind of doing the linking. Okay, so Jamie's into football, I'm into family, and for me to have a nice, cool relationship with my son, I'll put up with the bloody football.
Yeah, and I think the point is, like, if you can find that common area, activities that previously seemed like someone's activity, oh, like, you know, it's really important for Jamie to do X, but I really can't be asked as Amy. And therefore the activity seems as Jamie's activity, and now Jamie owes you one for coming along. That type of dynamic is just totally removed if you can see what's in it for you. And for you to see what's in it for you, it probably relies on me saying, look, Amy, it's actually, this is an activity, this is Amy's thing. It's movement, it's human behavior. And all of a sudden we've lost this kind of slightly nasty ping pong game that was going on.
Totes. And I just thought of a story, which is quite fun, which is very indicative of the value systems. So a few years ago, Dad, Susanna, our sister, and I were going to go on holiday to South France. And we had a flight that was leaving the airport probably like 11 a.m. And our father has a high value on arriving at the airport the day before the flight, practically. And so he wanted me to sleep over at his house to make sure that I'd get up early, that we'd be able to leave at like 6:30 for this 11:30 flight. Obviously, I'm exaggerating a little bit. But at the time, I had a dog and a boyfriend. And we weren't living in the same house, boyfriend and I. And so there was like this logistical situation where I was going to have to kind of like organize for the boyfriend to take the dog, and then for me to get to the airport. And I was like, oh God, like, and the boyfriend also lived at the complete other side of London, but also quite near the airport, quite relatively close to Gatwick. So I was like, hey dad, can I take the dog down to Will's place, stay over at Will's place, and then meet you at the airport? Father has a hissy fit. He's like, absolutely no way, because I have a slight reputation for arriving late to things. He starts like stressing that we might miss the flight and that, you know, then the whole holiday is ruined, you know, that kind of thing. And so we had this like kind of like big fight about it, because his value is to get there early, have a nice time, that kind of thing. And my value is like, I've got a life, I have a dog, and that's important for me. So then, okay, so how do we meet in the middle? In order for me to get what I wanted, it's all about like, how can I get what I want while you get what you want? How do we create like a win-win situation? And so I can't actually remember my solution. Oh, I can't. Okay. So then I was like, I create this whole like scheme of, okay, well, if I stay over at Will's place, I'll have extra person to make sure that I wake up in the morning. I'll have already packed, so there won't be any kind of last minute scrambles for stuff, because it's all done already. And I'm close to the airport. Will is definitely going to hold me accountable for like kicking me out of the house on time. And I'll meet you there and everything will be fine. Didn't quite transpire that way. In the end, I had to back down and stay over. But it was just like a whole kind of situation of example of, okay, well, what do you care about? As in, what does dad care about? Arriving on time, making sure we get on the flight. And also not being anxious about that whole situation.
Yeah. And it's interesting just because, like, you know, when you're negotiating with someone about something, quite often we think, oh, well, you can just like make a different offer.
Or what a lot of people do, which is a real mistake, is say, if you do this, it will mean so much to me. And they make it all about me. And that is, I think, where we go wrong, because that's kind of a bit like a guilt trip. And then people are a bit like, well, fuck you.
It's also playing the same game, though, because you're basically saying, to the degree you care about me, you should care about this thing. So you're still putting it in terms they care about. You're just making yourself the center of that. What I was going to say was, you know, usually when you're negotiating in, like, I don't know, a business context, there's this idea that you have a range of options. So you have like, okay, well, I'll offer you more money, less money, throw this in, take that away. But the art here is you're actually not changing the activity. I wasn't making football less like football, or you weren't trying to stay less at Will's than you previously were. The outcome remains the same. So the art is translating a static outcome, one that's unmoving, into something that people care about, which is a totally different type of negotiating. And it's a different type of value adding activity altogether.
Yes, it's all about creating like the win-win situation. And really, win-win in what is truly meaningful for the other person and linking it to what is meaningful for them. This is like a kind of like slightly ideal scenario. Sometimes it doesn't transpire that way. Sometimes you just have to like shut up and put up with something that you don't want to do. Or just be honest and be like, if you make me go to the opera when I hate the opera, I'm going to sit there pissed off and resentful that I'm there. Do you really want me to go to the opera with you under such situation? Or would you rather go with someone who wants to be there?
Yeah, and there's another point here about values and relationships, which is if you can just be really honest about what it is you like, care about, effectively who you are, although that term is slightly Disney for me, well then people's expectations of you are appropriate. And relationships aren't damaged because people are expecting something of you that they shouldn't be. You know, like you're only gutted when someone isn't going to the opera if you had some idea that they might or some idea that they should. If you really accepted that they are like the least opera person in the world, there's no disappointment. It's not even a conversation.
Totally. And what's even kind of like really cool about this kind of thing is, and I'm going to use my own kind of life example. So for example, me and my current boyfriend, Seb, is not massively into going out to dinner. He doesn't mind it, but it's not like his favorite thing. And in the beginning of our relationship, I was like, oh dear, this could be a red flag, because I love to go out for dinner. I love food. I love different experiences. I love to taste different stuff, all that kind of thing. And now I've got this boyfriend who normally I would expect to want to do that stuff with me, who doesn't want to do that. I was like, uh-oh. And so I had to rejig my entire thinking and think, okay, well, who can I go to dinner with instead? And I made a list of like 1,000 people, maybe not 1,000, maybe 10, which was sufficient. And then what are the benefits to me that I go with those people rather than with the boyfriend who doesn't want to go? And then what would be the drawbacks to me if I do go with him when he doesn't want to be there?
Yeah, and it seems kind of obvious when you say it like that, because you see the boyfriend the whole time anyway, right? And you cook with the boyfriend and you eat with the boyfriend. So what a cool opportunity to use something that has to happen, which is eating, to connect with these other people who, to be totally honest, are more likely to get binned off and forgotten about than the boyfriend, at least in the short term.
Yeah, and doing this whole exercise made me realize, okay, so going out for dinner with someone else, I have a completely different interaction with someone with a completely different set of values, with a different way of seeing things, different thought processes. Then we have an interesting conversation. I then get a sort of different kind of fulfillment from hanging out with that person. I get to have the delicious food that I love and be in these like nice places that I love going to. And then I get to kind of go back to the boyfriend enriched with this different and new experience. And so I get then to share that different experience with him, kind of relive it, but not quite relive it, but just like, you know, share that experience and any kind of nuggets or things that I've learned with the other person with him. And then we all kind of have this like learning experience from this thing.
Yeah, and that's all facilitated by you recognizing the fact that he's just not interested in this thing. And I mean, it's sort of a difficult point, but like people aren't going to be interested in what you care about a lot of the time. And when you do find someone who has like an overlap of a couple of interests with you, the reason that's so quite exciting is because it's so rare. I mean, how often are you like, do you meet a random person, a stranger, a randomer, and get, oh my God, and you also think this thing about this thing, and this is so super niche and obscure. It's happened so rarely. So we sort of have to learn to operate in the world, I think, I guess, of like people not caring about what you care about, even if you care about it lots.
Yes, and accepting that we're all different and accepting that, you know, I'm into cats, you might not be, and not expecting you to be into cats. But we tend to have that wisdom with people that we're not romantically engaged with. But when it's a lover, I don't know what happens. There's some like weird shit that goes on in the brain. It's like, oh, this is a romantic person. That means they must adhere to all of the things that are important to me. And it's just not how it works.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting point that with romantic relationships, we're basically less wise, less mature, more expectant that they'll be into everything you're into. Whereas with friends and certainly strangers, those expectations are right in check. But I think it's much easier to transition from I'm a romantic partner and therefore I expect you to like everything I like to, oh, well, you can do your own thing and that's great for me. If you understand there are benefits to them having their own stuff going on, like as soon as you see that, like, oh, actually, it's nice to go with these other people, well, then all of a sudden, just the spontaneous objectivity hits of, oh, no, they don't have to be into what I'm into. You know, everyone's different. But it's very hard to be there if you actually secretly think life would be way better if they were into what you were into.
This is very true. And I think this, a similar thing can happen also with marriages and romantic relationships where there is an expectation that the husband or wife is number one. So, for example, if you're the husband and you expect that you should be number one in the life of your wife, got very confused with the words that rhymed. If you're expecting to be number one, then you're going to when you're not. When the truth occurs and you realize that, okay, shit, I'm not number one in this person's life. But actually, do you really need to be number one? Because there's a lot of pressure at the top there when you are number one, because then so much of what you do influences how that person behaves and how they feel and their kind of life stuff. You're kind of setting yourself up for major jealousy. And I've seen this with a few clients recently who were expecting themselves to be number one in the life of the husband or wife. It's generally been like the husband, actually. But the husband has felt frustrated within themselves about various things. And they've had some sort of connection with somebody else that's not the wife. And there is something that the other person can give them that the wife can't. But that's normal. But the wife is expecting herself to be able to provide everything for the husband. To provide, you know, emotional, mental, intellectual, financial, familial, all of the areas of life. She's expecting to herself to provide for him. But the reality is, nobody can do that, which is why we have more than one person in life, which is why we need the rich variety of interaction. Because, you know, he's an academic, for example, and she's not, and he needs his academic intellectual stimulus, which he can get from other sources, but she feels undermined when he gets it from other sources, and then she feels uncomfortable, and then they have friction, and then big drama.
Yeah, exactly. And it's why, again, just articulating your values and recognizing that other people have values inevitably means you realize you can't be everything to everyone, or you can't be everything to anyone, in fact. Like, you know, because as soon as you see that your husband's an academic and clearly cares about academia and all the things that are associated, if you're not an academic, but even if you are, it's just very obvious you can't provide all of that, especially if the next thing he loves is cricket. What, are you now supposed to be like a cricket-playing academic? It's never going to happen. But in order to get there, it's just worth articulating the objective truth of there's things I care about, there's things you care about. They're not quite the same. There is a hierarchy. And therefore, I can't possibly expect myself to be everything to you and vice versa. Is that kind of the shape?
Yes. And also, there are some situations where actually one person will have the wisdom to say, I actually don't expect this of you. My expectations of you are not to provide the academic simulation because I know that that's not what you're into. And I'm happy getting it from Bob and Richard, I don't know, or whoever. Or even if it is like, you know, a potential romantic rival, if you're going to allow yourself to feel undermined by that and think, oh gosh, I don't know, let's give her a name, Ruby is providing some kind of academic stimulation that I can't provide, therefore the whole marriage is in jeopardy. That's not necessarily the case. And also, if you try to stop that from happening, and try to interfere with the interactions between Ruby and husband, he's going to get resentful of you because he's not getting his academic fix. And then it actually makes the other thing more appealing, and then makes Ruby much more appealing and interesting, because Ruby has something that you want, but the forbidden fruit means that you're not allowed it. Suddenly, Ruby is way more attractive.
Yeah, that is an argument, especially in like polyamorous circles, that go, having only one partner is kind of the equivalent of telling a teenager, like, don't do that thing. Like, if someone's going to want to smoke, they're going to end up smoking or be really fucking resentful of the fact they can't. So those are your two options. And better to let them have the cigarette and get bored of smoking and realize, like, it kind of makes your teeth smell bad, and then that's fine. That's edgy, though. That's an edgy view, because it basically ends up implying that the objective truth that you can't be everything for anyone ends up meaning that one partner is never enough, which I think is a pretty radical take. That, like, you need to do more work there, I think.
I think the funny thing about it, not that I'm an expert on this, I'm going to say, but just in the sense that we have more than one parent, we have more than one friend, we might have a sibling, we might have two siblings. There are just multiple people in our lives. Yet when it comes to a romantic thing, I don't know whether it's a natural thing for humans to be in a two-person couple. I think that's a kind of more recent evolution that kind of religion has imposed upon us. And the reason I kind of know this is because, and this is a bit disgusting, so brace yourself for something disgusting. Apparently, and anthropologists will know much more about this than I do, apparently, the shape of the male penis, because there's no female penis, is such that it provides a kind of suction action, because human beings used to be so promiscuous, and they literally used to have, I don't know, like raging orgies. And in order for one dude to ensure that his seed fertilized the lucky lady who had just bonked, I don't know, Peter, in order for Simon to get his seed through to the egg, the shape of the penis was designed such that the action of the kind of the pumping would suck out the previous man's jizz. And I'm so sorry that this is quite disgusting, but apparently this is the thing, because we used to be so promiscuous, and then we're now expecting ourselves to be kind of the opposite.
How have we got here?
I don't know.
I think the point is, yeah, right, we're definitely built at different times to be promiscuous or have more than one partner. And like the fact that anyone with a partner is still attracted to other people kind of pays homage to that fact. The question is whether there's just relative to benefit to keeping yourself with one person. And it certainly is true in the context of kids, right? Like the evidence is in on that one. We understand, we know that kids work better in environments where there aren't a million romantic partners going about. And there's maybe a couple of studies that say, well, actually, you know, in this instance, villagers raise kids, and it's not quite clear who the families are. But it looks like there's quite a lot of other factors that need to be true for that to be in place. So generally speaking, I guess the question is, this is less colourful than your example, I'm afraid. But I guess the question is about weighing up the relative benefits of being with one person. Because you might argue, yeah, I can't get everything from one person. But the fact that they are my only person that I'm romantic with does give the relationship a type of quality that it might miss out on otherwise.
Agreed. And I think, yeah, like it has a kind of specialness, but everything is like a double-edged sword, right? It's a two-sided coin. So with that specialness, you run the risk of, if anything happens to that person and they're no longer available anymore, then you suffer much more because you put all of your eggs into that basket and you haven't given space for other people around you to kind of contribute to your life in a meaningful way. Similarly, kind of on a similar theme, like there's a relationship expert called Esther Perel who has done lots of research into relationships. She says up until about the 1950s, we had lots of people in our lives, lots more people. And the marriage had a particular function, which was kind of, as you say, for the kids. And people kind of just had affairs. And that was kind of sort of okay. We sort of turned a blind eye. But on top of having an affair, you know, the women had all their women friends. The men had their kind of colleagues and their kind of male friends and whoever, but they didn't have the same kind of relationships. We had just much more interaction with other people. And so the expectations of the marriage were different from what they are now. Nowadays, we are expecting everything from one person. And we are therefore more likely to encounter friction, butting up against each other, because we're going to be imposing our values onto that person, potentially more so because we're expecting everything from this one person.
Yeah, and I think as the world's got more romantic, and it's no bad thing that it's got more romantic, but like, you know, marriage for love is quite a recent idea. Like, it's such a surprising fact when you hear that. It's literally like 300 years old.
It's actually funny that you say that, because there was a thing on Netflix, some like Indian matchmaking show, and the parents of the people who were trying to find a partner, a husband, were all like, you know, these love marriages, like this bullshit. You know, these young people, they want to love the person. Like, what nonsense. They were like, no, we get married to have the babies and the children and to kind of have a kind of respectable family, not to have a bloody love situation.
Yeah, and in that context, like, given that that was the standard, it's very easy to see why you would increasingly expect more and more from just one person. And the expectations that places can often make that a disappointing time. Like, lots of marriages that aren't fine would probably be fine if everyone just thought, okay, I can't be everything for this one person, but I can be a lot of things, and vice versa. And secretly, would I really want to be their one person? And would I be happy for them to be my only person in a reciprocal way? Would I be happy to give up all the extra bits? To which the answer is probably going to be no in a marriage. Maybe that's just a fundamental problem at the heart of the whole fucking thing.
I would say so. Let's just remember not to impose our values onto everybody around us, particularly the romantic partner. And remember to, if you're trying to get the person to do something, sell it to them in a way that really appeals to them, and make sure that they are doing something because they are appreciative of the benefits that it's going to bring them, truly for them.
Brilliant. Well, Ames, thank you for that. And everyone at home, thank you for listening. This has been Get a Move On with Amy Slevin. And as always, we'll see you next week.